Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest on Writers' Voice today is Joyce Lee Malcolm. Now, Joyce is an emeritus professor at Antonin Scalia Law School, George Mason University. She is the author of Guns and Violence, Peter's War, To Keep and Bear Arms, and The Tragedy of Benedict Arnold. She lives in Alexandria, Virginia, and the title of the book that we're talking about today is The Times That Try Men's Souls, The Adams, The Quincys, and The Battle for Loyalty in the American Revolution. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Joyce.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really looking forward to this discussion.
So tell me what made you want to, well, first of all, let's just say what this book is really about. So it's about the American Revolution, but it's about a certain aspect of it.
Yes, I tried to get as close to what it would have been like living through it as possible. John Adams said, posterity, you will never know what it costs the present generation to preserve your liberty. And part of what it cost was the divisions of families, the splits that were not healed between fathers and children and husbands and wives and sisters and brothers. And that was a kind of sadness and poignancy that I think gets overlooked in a lot of the discussion.
It certainly does. And, you know, as when we were learning it back in school days, learning about the Revolutionary War, we learned about Tories, which were colonists who were loyal to Britain, but because history is written by the victors, they were sort of just the enemy. There wasn't any focus on the fact that they were your neighbors, friends, and family. And that's what this book is really about.
Yes, I tried to take a close look at the Quincys, the Adamses, some of the other people in the area whose information I got. A lot of the founders had divided families, and also the people who defended, or at least sided with Britain, and went into exile. So these were loyalists, but they never raised their arms against the Americans. They just left for their own safety, and were called absentees, thinking they would be able to come back quickly. Everybody always thinks a war will end quickly, and it almost never does. And so it's really quite sad because they left thinking they'd be back quickly with no idea how long they were going to be away, with no necessarily means of support. And once they were gone, after the war started, they were banished. So in Massachusetts, Samuel Quincy, who had gone into exile, was banished. And there was a whole list of 300 people who'd gone into exile and were banished. If you came back without permission the first time, they would transport you to British territory. If you came back a second time, you would be executed. And in the meantime, after you were banished, they confiscated your property and sold it at auction. So basically, once gone, that was it. You know, there was no reconciliation until much later. And that was really sad. And happily for me, I have a lot of letters of the people writing back and forth, but they were not able to sort of come back to home as they realized it was their home.
So since you were writing about people who are pretty prominent in that time of our history, and that's probably been a fairly well-researched time of history.
Yes,
So I'm guessing that you had a lot of source material to work from.
I was very fortunate.
Yeah.
Thank God for the Adamses. Volumes of their letters to each other, which are wonderful because they really get you into the aspects of daily life, you know, with Abigail complaining that John is off in Congress and she's left to manage the farm and the children. I mean, there are a lot of things that you would not know about otherwise. And there are others other collections of letters. And these have been tremendously helpful in kind of getting at the voice of the people of the time. I wrote a book some time ago called Peter's War about a slave child from Massachusetts who was sold in 1765. And I was able to trace who his real parents were and what happened to him and how he fought in the war. But I never had anything he had personally written. And so it really is tremendously helpful to have those sources.
How much time did you spend poring through those letter collections?
Oh, a lot. And I should say, too, that much of this was written during COVID, so a lot of libraries were closed. And I was very lucky to be able to get things online. And also, as a side for your listeners, you can now get books that are out of print made up for you, a facsimile. So I was able to buy the town meeting records of the town of Braintree, where they all live. Now, this might not be something that a lot of people want to buy, but it's to be able to own. And using that, I could look and see what was happening at that town meeting when they were worried about the Stamp Act or they were worried about something else. And to discover that, in fact, one of the items on the agenda was whether the pigs should be allowed to run free. You know, how many taverns really want to have in town because we're very sober people. So it really is a reflection in how what was going on outside, you know, affecting them, impacted or didn't impact on, you know, sort of daily life. But that is a great resource, being able to own a book like that.
Where do you get those? How do you get those?
Actually, I just went online and looked for it. And I think Amazon even will make a copy. And I think it was only something like $30.
Wow.
So, I mean, if you wait to borrow something from a library, it can take days and then you can only have it a short amount of time. So it was great to be able to own them, and some of the books on the shelves behind me are things that I was able to purchase. I own a collection of the Adams papers and some of these others. So I'm really grateful that there was all this written material and that a lot of it was preserved.
Now, like it used to be as a historian doing research, you'd have to go to whoever had the collection of the letters and you'd put on the white gloves, right? To actually look at the letters sometimes? Did you have to do that for this at all?
White gloves for some reason. On television, other people do it. But you always had to go, and that was difficult. I remember some of the early work I did was in Britain, and you know, you could wait for hours in the library for them to get the things that you needed to look at. And, you know, only had it a certain amount of time. So it was much more time consuming. And we're really lucky now. There's a collection, I think, of Benjamin Franklin's letters online. And you can put in the year and see all the letters they've got and click on a letter and up it comes.
Wow.
So our task has been made easier. On the other hand, we don't get to go to interesting places.
Yeah, no excuse for a tax write-off trip to London, huh?
No more. Well, there's still some things, but anyway, it was a great help that these things are now available. So
Is there any difference to you when you're doing this research to reading a copy of the letter online versus actually holding the letter in your hands?
It's wonderful to hold the letter in your hand and to see it.
Yeah.
So sometimes the ones that are copied online are transcribed so that you don't have to puzzle over what that word was.
It's interesting how beautiful everybody's handwriting seemed to be back then, but how difficult to decipher sometimes.
Yeah, although I always feel that as a historian who dealt with student papers, very good at trying to figure out what it is that they're writing.
I have quite a number of letters from my ancestors, so from the 1800s. And they're, of course, they're very faded, a lot of them too, which makes it even harder. But the handwriting is just almost without exception so much better than my handwriting is in terms of the aesthetic appearance of it. But I do struggle sometimes trying to figure out what they were saying.
Sometimes there's an ink blot over something important.
Yes.
But they were really very careful, and happily a lot of these letters were preserved so we can get the correspondence back and forth.
Now, did you learn anything that surprised you when you were researching this?
Yes, in fact, I felt like I learned a lot. One of the things that surprised me was the sheer number of families that had splits and divisions ideologically, political differences, and how they dealt with it or didn't deal with it. I learned that the Americans who went into exile as absentees didn't fit in to the English society at all. There was no place for them. I mean, the English have this very rigid, you know, structured society, and you could be a very important person in America, but when you got there, you were not a noble, you weren't even necessarily a country gentleman. There was no place for them, and they stayed together. They tended to live in groups. They had shops where they met. They tried to, you know, just sort of keep in touch with other Americans, but there was this also this kind of defensiveness because the British would poo-poo, oh, this is going to be so easy to take a group of British soldiers across that country and, you know, we'll get these people conquered in no time at all. And they realized that this was really bothersome to them. I mean, you know, however much they wanted or the idea of British government, they didn't like this condescension toward America.
Right. Well, what was the, you know, we hear about the Boston Tea Party, although that was really, I learned some things about that reading your book, that it wasn't so much the middle of the night and all secret and stuff, that it all kind of happened out in, they sort of were allowed to do it in a way. Do you want to tell us about that a little bit? Because that was surprising to me.
It was to me too, and actually the lieutenant governor, then Governor Hutchinson, got blamed for being so rigid about not wanting the tea to land. All this tea was part of a special bill in Parliament for the British East India Company to have a monopoly on tea. They had this huge warehouse full of tea in Britain. So they gave them this monopoly, and the tea that was brought to Boston in these three ships would have been cheaper than the smuggled tea. So once it landed, people were likely to buy it, you know. And so there was up
even
to
with the tax, it was cheaper.
Even with the tax, it was cheaper. So you had to be pretty stubbornly independent to pay more for smuggled tea. And you know, of course, John Hancock was one of the great smugglers.
Oh, follow the money.
And the British had a terrible time, actually, when there was just the smuggling, to get American juries to convict the smugglers because they were very sympathetic. So they are almost never able to convict them. So here's this tea even cheaper. And there was a lot of concern among the governor and the pro-British people who felt that tea should not be allowed to land, and they couldn't get the governor to send those ships back. And by the way, those ships were all owned by Americans. They were chartered by Americans, which may be the reason I didn't put it in. Which may be the reason why nobody objected, no fighting when they went on board. So a group of desperate Sons of Liberty, disguised as Narragansett Indians, went on board these ships. And I don't know if you've ever seen a tea chest, but very heavy. It's a heavy, solid thing. So they were allowed to board these three ships that had the tea shortly before it was supposed to be unloaded. And brought up all these chests and broke them open with hatchets and dumped the tea in the harbor. And there were some Americans who got on board and tried to salvage some of that tea that was scattered about for their own use. Less patriotic in that sense. But the amount of tea that was destroyed was about $1.7 million in modern money. So it was a huge amount of money.
Wow.
And the British insisted that the Boston government pay for the tea, make good that loss. And they refused to do it. And that was, and in fact, Benjamin Franklin, who was then in London, thought that they should pay, that would have been fair. The argument, I guess, on the other side is, well, we didn't do this. Why should we pay? Of course, there were some of them who did do it, but they were disguised. Anyway, they didn't. And that was, it was the Tea Party that really provoked serious action against Massachusetts by the Parliament, and that almost led directly to war, you know, closing the harbor, putting a military man in charge of Boston, having to give permission for town meetings like this one in Braintree.
Okay.
So they really clamped down.
So as the result of some individuals basically breaking the law and every law, because they went and they took property that wasn't theirs, they destroyed it,
yes,
refused to pay for it, and then the reaction to that is what actually led to the restriction of liberty that really caused people to revolt.
Yes, yes, it did.
Interesting. And did they? And it sounds like from what you're writing that at least Samuel Adams probably wanted that was an intentional act.
Oh yeah, before that he despaired that people were so lethargic, no one was rioting. You know, they had gotten the Stamp Act repealed and things had quieted down since the.
I mean, they were just taxing tea at that point. That was the only thing they were taxing, right?
And
it doesn't seem that. I'm sorry, but. That horrible, because there were soldiers there that were, had, there'd been the French Indian War and the soldiers had, so Britain had paid for all of this. It doesn't seem that outrageous to extract some tax to cover those costs.
You might have been a loyalist.
I might have been.
It wasn't outrageous, and I tried to cover the taxes that the people in Britain were paying. They had paid for this army to come for the French and Indian War. They were heavily taxed. A lot of the taxes Americans were complaining about, the British people had for a very long time. So it seemed, in fact, I think that the Stamp Act, the tax on playing cards, the British had, I think, right up until the 20th century without revolting about it. So it was, I think there was just this very anxious attitude among the colonists that they were very jealous of their liberties and they wanted their own legislature to do the taxing. And so they were very upset about anything that looked like it was intruding on their rights.
Of course, there were only there was a very small proportion that actually had liberty. White landowning men.
Oh, well, I mean, in America?
In America, yeah. There were a lot of people that didn't have much liberty at all. So,
well, I think there was probably more that, you know, they had the rights of Englishmen.
Yeah.
And all of the charters, the first charters that were given for these different colonies, guaranteed them the rights of Englishmen as if born and abiding in England. And that was what they were worried about, wanting to preserve their rights as Englishmen and very proud of those rights. And in fact, if they hadn't been guaranteed those rights, I don't know if they could have gotten people to come to this forsaken and wild place.
Right, you know? Right. But no, so, I just mean that, you know, women couldn't vote in a lot of colonies. Men couldn't, who didn't own land, couldn't vote.
Yes.
Black people obviously had no liberty whatsoever. So, you know,
oh, there were a lot of people on the way we look at liberty. You know, there were a lot of people that couldn't vote. There were a lot of people whose rights were infringed. I mean, they had the right of trial by jury, most people. They had, you know, the right to petition. They had self-government to a certain extent. They had these town meetings in Massachusetts where all the adult men could come and vote. Although in some places you had to belong to the right church. So there were a lot of restrictions.
Right, yeah.
Looking back, those look terrible, but for that time period, they were generous. But even then, they didn't want America to be treated like Ireland. They didn't want the parliament to be legislating for them.
Right.
So however limited their liberty seems to us, they didn't want to lose what they
have. They didn't want to lose what they have. And that I would have agreed with for sure. I don't know if I would have agreed to the point of armed revolution though, you know, living in that time. How about you?
Well, I tried to make no judgments.
Yeah.
You know, because I think that it's easy for us centuries later to look back and say, well, everybody should have taken on the great British Empire and not worried about, you know, being called traitors and all slaughtered or hanged. But there were really serious concerns both sides. I mean, there were a lot of people who just wanted law and order. This was the only colony that ever revolted against an empire at that time. It's amazing to me they thought that they would win. If they hadn't been so far from the home country, they probably wouldn't. And if we hadn't had French help, we would not have won.
Right, right.
But we were lucky. We were very lucky. But there were a lot of people who couldn't see how it would work out if we were independent. And then, of course, there was a lot of use of violence and intimidation. And the Sons of Liberty were responsible at the beginning for actually drumming up a mob during the Stamp Act of 3,000 people marching through Boston and destroying people's homes and threatening their lives. And I have to admit that when I was a school kid, I thought that tarring and feathering was very funny. It was not funny. There were a lot of threats. And
yeah.
So I think that there were a lot of people who felt intimidated and had wanted nothing to do with remaining and their neighbors, you know, taking advantage of them and being rude to them and destroying their property. So, you know, they fled for safety. They didn't flee in order to fight against the British or fight against the Americans.
Right. Yeah. It seemed like, you know, Governor Hutchison gets a lot of the blame, but he was walking a razor's edge, wasn't he?
He was. I'd like to just read you what they did to his house.
Sure. Sure.
The Stamp Act. That was when the Sons of Liberty first started the use of mob violence. And I'll just say, he found out that the mob had finished his destruction of the Customs House in Admiralty, and it marched on his house, and he had this really lovely house in Boston. He writes, I directed my children to fly to a secure place, and I shut up my house as I had done before. He later wrote, he and his daughter fled to a neighbor's house just seconds ahead of the mob. His son, still in the house, also just managed to escape as the mob hacked open the door and rampaged through the rooms. He and his family escaped just in time. With the crowd giving chase, Hutchinson fled to the yards and gardens to a house more remote, where he remained until 4 in the morning, by which time one of the best finished houses in the province had nothing remaining but the bare walls and floors. The mob took vengeance on his great house, breaking down the doors with axes, destroying or stealing everything inside, tearing down the woodwork. They were furious and feral in a frenzy. They hacked down partition walls and the cupola he had, stripped the slates and boards from the roof, and they even cut down all his trees. Such ruin, he wrote, was never seen in America. And you know, it's amazing after that he stayed on, but it was terrible. And you can imagine the anger. And people like Sam Adams thought, okay, well, it worked, because after that, nobody wanted to have anything to do with selling the government stamps. So that kind of violence worked. But once you get a mob going, it's very hard to stop it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened to him. And he had been.
Now, what year was that?
That was in 1765.
Okay. So when did the war actually begin?
10 years later, in 1775.
Yeah.
So the Tea Party was in 1774, late 1774. And then these very restrictive acts were put into place. And actually the parliamentary government and the king sort of blamed Hutchinson, who was still hanging on there as governor. If I had been my house, I think I would have quit my job. But at any rate, he stayed on. But they recalled him, and he went to into exile in England. And, you know, it was really someone who read his diary there described it as the profoundly pathetic record of a man brokenhearted by his expatriation. I mean, he was in exile. At first, the king consulted with him about what was going on. And then after that, he was kind of ignored. He had 25 people dependent on him there. He writes in his diary, he said, "Upon the whole, I'm more of a New England man than ever, and I will not despair of seeing my country and friends again, though I fear the time for it is further off than I imagined." And then later he said, "My greatest wish is to lay my bones in my native soil." There were four generations of family who had lived and died in Massachusetts. So it's hard not to feel really sorry for this man he was a government official and wasn't especially cruel, but he was trying to just carry out the government's wishes and, you know, suffer.
He was doing his job.
He was doing his job and then got blamed by not only the colonists, but by the king for doing it a little too rigidly. He should have let the tea land or sent the ships back. So he strikes me as a very, very sad character. And he ends up dying and being buried in a church in England next to the daughter who passed away before him.
Was there anything that the British could have done differently that would have avoided the revolution from your perspective?
Yeah, I think that if they had allowed the Americans to tax themselves, that would have done it. I mean, eventually, late in the war, when they're trying to make sure that we don't fall under the control of the French and Spanish, and they are ready to make some concessions, they were willing to give up a lot of the things that would have ended the war had it been offered at the very beginning.
Oh, wow.
But what's really sad, I think, is that on both sides, people dug in, you know. So in the colonies, it's the most radical people, like Sam Adams and others, who take control of the colonial governments. And in Britain, it's the Parliament and the King who are determined to make sure that the Americans toe the line, obey the law, realize how lucky they are to be part of the British Empire. So there would have been the chances for reconciliation were there, but they were ignored. I mean, the American Congress, the Continental Congress, didn't pass something called the Olive Branch Petition, in which, to please the moderates in the Congress, they, Majesty's dutiful subjects, offered to see all these things reconciled. But the very immediately after passing this and sending it off to the king, they voted $2 million for an army and appointed a whole lot of officers. So on the one hand, they're trying to make some conciliation, some gesture, and on the other hand, here they are, you know, preparing for war. So it's really hard at that stage. And the other point is that even after the Battle of Lexington and Concord in 1775, Benjamin Franklin went around the country and he said he didn't find anyone who wanted independence. So you think something might have been done early on, but wow, we missed chances.
Yeah. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Joyce Lee Malcolm, author of The Times That Try Men's Souls, The Adams, The Quincys, and The Battle for Loyalty in the American Revolution. So we all know who the Adams are, John Adams, and right. Was Sam Adams his brother, or how were they related? Cousin. Okay. And then are the Quincys and Adams related as well?
There was a lot of mixing. And in fact, John Adams actually proposed to Samuel Quincy's sister, Hannah. And he was really smitten with her. But as he was proposing, they got interrupted and he never got back to it. So he ended up marrying Abigail much later. the Quincy division was really among the brothers. There were originally three Quincy sons. The father, Josiah Sr., was a great patriot. And his oldest son, Edmund, was a merchant and died of an illness at sea. So he had two sons left, both of Samuel and Josiah Jr., both of whom were lawyers. And Samuel had the position of being Solicitor General of Massachusetts for the Crown. His younger brother, Josiah, was a son of liberty and a prolific writer, always writing, you know, that whatever was going on, that the Americans needed to be ready to grab their swords and plunge them into the hands of their enemies, you know, the hearts of their enemies. So they couldn't have been more different. And during the trial of the soldiers who had shot these civilians at the Boston Massacre, Samuel represented the government side, which in fact prosecuted the soldiers very oddly, I think. And, you know, they prosecuted their own soldiers. And Josiah worked with John Adams to defend them. And they won. They won the defense. But these two brothers were on different sides.
I found this part of your book very fascinating because they were on different sides and on the opposite of what you would expect them to have been. So yes. The one that was on the British side was prosecuting the British soldiers, and the one that was on the revolutionary side was defending the British soldiers.
I know. I found that extraordinary. I had never really noticed that before. It just seemed so odd. But I think both sides wanted to show that you could get justice. So the British wanted to show that they wanted their soldiers to behave. And Samuel, for having defended the British side, was considered a hero. And these Sons of Liberty Samuel was prosecuting them. The Sons of Liberty who were defending them seemed kind of doubtful. And Josiah his father wouldn't believe that his younger son was actually going to do this. He said, "I won't believe it till I hear it from your very mouth." Josiah said, "Yes, I'm doing it. I was consulted with the Sons of Liberty, and they think it's a good thing to do." So they took odd sides. But what happened afterwards was that that Josiah was sent on a secret mission after in 1774 to England to see whether maybe they could persuade the British people that they shouldn't fight against the colonists, to give them our point of view. And on his way back to America, and within sight of Gloucester Harbor, he died at sea. And the first battle of the American Revolution had occurred while he was still at sea. So he never knew that the war had actually started and his whole mission had been in vain. His brother Samuel decided within a month of the Battle of Lexington and Concord, while the family was still mourning his younger brother, that he needed to go into exile. For some reason that I cannot discern, he seemed to think there would be great opportunities for him in England. And he left in May. His wife and children did not accompany him. She was a patriot. Her family was patriotic. She was taken, and his three children were taken in by her brother, who lived in Cambridge and who raised them. And Samuel was his father, Josiah Sr.'s only son. And there was a lot of upset. Well, they were still mourning the younger brother. He should leave and depart. The war was starting, and he was leaving what Josiah Sr. always considered himself an aged and infirm. But as I pointed out, he lived another 14 years. He was a tough old guy, however aged and infirm he may have been. But Samuel just left, so he thinking he'd be back by fall. So he leaves in May, and I'll be back. The opportunities there, and he never returns. He's banished. His property's confiscated. He never sees his children again.
That is so sad. How old would his children have been when he left?
They were, I'm just doing it from memory, but something like 6 and 7 and 8. He had 2 sons and 1 daughter, and they were raised in the home of their uncle. And later on, they wrote to him, you know, come home, please. And his wife did. She said, you know, why don't you just come back? It will all be okay. And he wrote and said, I'm not going to come back until I'm going to be treated properly. You know, he worried about what his children would think of him. And he also was worried because he didn't know how his dad was doing. I left him in a manner that I deeply regret, he said. Mm. He never heard from him, but he admits he never wrote to him either.
Oh,
he
wow.
said, well, what I have to say can't easily be put in writing. So they were never in touch. After the war, the British allowed the loyalists or the absentees who were in Britain to have posts in the government. And he got a post as a customs official in Antigua. And his wife, Hannah, who he had deserted years before, came to join him. And I wonder what that reunion was actually like. I mean, if I had been Hannah, I wouldn't have been too thrilled to see him. But she only lived a short time afterwards and died in his arms.
Oh.
And his 2 sons grew up to be lawyers and obviously felt so kind of ashamed of their father that one of them went to practice 100 miles to the west of Massachusetts. The other one went to practice 100 miles north into New Hampshire. They left home, basically, and went at a great distance.
Where no one knew that their father was what was at that point considered a traitor.
Yes, he was. Yeah. And all his property had been confiscated. He wrote to his friend saying, if you can, please save my law books. So that family was just sort of
torn apart.
It was torn apart, and the children grew up, you know, estranged from their father. And the one thing that I found a little even more poignant was that the grandfather, who had an estate and lots of farms, even though those children of Samuel's were being raised as patriots, he left everything to Josiah Jr.'s 1 12-year-old son, Josiah, who died at sea. So that 12-year-old got everything, and these 2 sons of Samuel's got nothing.
Oh, wow.
It wasn't their fault, but
that's the way it goes. Wow. So, do you have another section you'd like to read for us today?
Yes. This is going back to Samuel. When Josiah was writing one of his pamphlets after the British clamped down because of the Tea Party, he wrote this very violent pamphlet saying, I speak with shame, I speak it with indignation, we are slaves, but the Americans will have patriots and heroes who will form a band of brothers, men who will have memories and feelings, courage and swords, courage that shall inflame their ardent bosoms till their hands cleave to their swords and their swords to their enemies' hearts. He writes this violent pamphlet. And then he sends a copy of it to his brother Samuel, who's still there. Samuel writes, I thought in a very moderate fashion, he said, I cannot fail of remembering what talks about his testimony. He says, the convulsions of the times are nothing more to be lamented than the interruption of domestic harmony. We have hitherto, I trust, happily seconded the friendship of blood and the friendship of heart and affections. And though your intercourse with me not so free or frequent as it could be wished, yet the caution we preserved when together in conversing on the subject of politics will continue to prevent a clashing of the fiercer passions. It is a caution many a current American friend families know well. Then he ends up this, I thought, very moderate reply to this highly inflamed pamphlet that was sent to him. He ends up with a prayer. He said to his writing to his brother, hot-headed brother, God preserve you. God preserve you in health and longevity, the friend and patron, and at length the father of your country, and the eclat of your own times record you with honor to the memory of the latest ages, and especially the prayer nearest my heart, may you continue and have reason to continue the friend and companion of your most cordially affectionate brother. So he really, despite, you know, all the provocation, but of course then it didn't work out on the history of John Adams. His closest friend was a man named Jonathan Sewall. They had studied law together. They wrote each other. They traveled from court to court together. And Jonathan Sewall urged John Adams not to go to the Continental Congress. The Adams replied to him, the die is now cast. I've passed the Rubicon, sink or swim, live or die. Survive or perish with my country is my unalterable determination. And so Adams went off to the Continental Congress. Sewall's home, he was also a solicitor general for the British government in Massachusetts. His home was attacked by a mob, but fortunately he was not home at the time, just his wife was. And she went and confronted this motley mob, and she offered to give them their wine cellar if they would disperse. And the mob thought about it and decided that sounded like a good idea. They left. But Sewall was really concerned, and he moved his family into Boston, which was under British control. And then later in 1775, he fled to England. His wife was a cousin of the Quincy's, Dorothy Quincy. Her younger sister was married to John Hancock. So she's in exile with her family permanently. And her sister is married to John Hancock. And later on in the war, she writes John about how depressed her husband is abroad. And he went into his room and stayed for 18 months and wouldn't come out. What can she do? And so they were in touch, but those two sisters never saw each other again. John Adams and Jonathan Sewall met many years later after the war, and they both recorded their comments, which is kind of nice to get both sides. And Sewall said, Adams came and took his hands in his and said, how wonderful to see you, my old friend. And they talked for 2 hours about things and how things were going. And then afterwards, they each made a comment about meeting. And Sewall writes, Adams is really the wrong person to be a diplomat. It isn't in his personality. And Adams writes, Sewall's such a sad man. He just lives for his children. It's sort of nice to be able to kind of eavesdrop.
Yeah.
Both sides of it.
Oh, it's interesting because, living for your children isn't a bad thing. Necessarily.
No.
Or a sad thing, necessarily.
Well, he had sons and he was worried about their having some kind of inheritance.
Mm.
And then, of course, the one that's best known having split was Benjamin Franklin, he had one son, William, who he was very close to. And Franklin's autobiography was dedicated to William, to his son William. But during the war, son William was the royalist governor of New Jersey. And here's his father, such a prominent founder and a patriot, and his son, you know, working for the British as the governor of New Jersey. So eventually William gets put under house arrest and sent to New York, which was under British control. And he was sent on what was called parole. And that's sort of the origins of what we call parole. But if you were paroled during war, you were allowed to go free on the promise that you wouldn't get involved again. You would just stay out of it. But William did not stay out of it. He was in New York and he was plotting and doing all kinds of things to help the royal cause. And after the war, he went into exile to Britain with the British army and the rest of the establishment there. And his Franklin was posted to England on a diplomatic mission, and he met with William. And William wanted to know at Franklin's will he would inherit. And it seems a little right at that point. Well, wait, Franklin let him have it, actually. He said, you're not going to get anything, because if you had won, I wouldn't have anything to give you. And so they never reconciled.
Aww.
So there were prominent families. There were the Quincys were less known what was going on in their family. There were many others. There were a lot of absentees who wanted to come back after the war. And in the treaty, there was some provision made that the states should be asked if these absentees could come back for 12 months and try and sort out their estates and maybe be forgiven or whatever, be able to be accommodated. But it was only the states were to be asked politely if these people could come back. And a lot of them were not keen. There was one man who was fate I follow, Kerwin, who was a judge in Salem, Massachusetts, and had gone into exile because his neighbors were very rude and unpleasant. His wife didn't accompany him, but in her case, it wasn't that she was a patriot. She was afraid to travel on the ocean, so she stayed. But he was always complaining. He was living hand to mouth. He had made a mistake. He should have stayed home. It was better to be insulted by your neighbors than to be out of money in Britain. And then he isn't banished. For some reason, he has enough friends so that he wasn't banished. But he can't make up his mind whether to come back or not. And he's getting a small stipend from the government in Britain, which he always complains is too little. But if he comes back, he won't get it at all. So he's not sure what to do. And finally, he makes up his mind. He will chance it. His friends are saying, come back. And he does come back to Salem, and everybody welcomes him. And, you know, and all's well. But so there were people that were on both sides and not really sure what was the best thing to do in it. And it was really hard. And of course, most of them, I'd like to, can I just read you the last?
Sure, sure.
Very part of the book here after the last of them died. And of course, Adams becomes the second president and his son, Quincy Adams, becomes a president. Right. So the generation that experienced that war without an enemy passed away. Those patriots living at home left to succeeding generations of Americans a new land with new freedoms and new challenges. And the memory of the divisions that tore apart families gradually faded, but would remain embedded in the story of the founding of the country. Thousands of loyalists who never returned went to Canada or elsewhere in the British Empire to begin the process of creating a new home in the new country. And just finally, Thomas Jefferson, in the first draft of his Declaration of Independence, writes, "We might have been a free and a great people together." And I sort of feel that's so sad. I mean, that we in the British, we families in America, of Americans on both sides, if only they had taken advantage of the opportunities to reconcile.
Yeah, we don't think of the Revolutionary War as a civil war, but in many ways it was.
It definitely was. And in fact, when I told people that I was writing about families divided, they assumed that it was the American Civil War.
Yeah.
But this one, in some ways, it's harder because the American Civil War was mostly divided along geographical lines.
Mm-hmm.
Here you have within families, you know, members of the Continental Congress who had families who were exiled and were still wanting to execute loyalists at home. And there, you know, it was much more mixed and very hard to be a neutral because you had to take an oath to support the opposition to Britain. So it was supposedly the only something like 20% of people were activists. But I think it was difficult whatever you did, whether you left, whether you stayed, or whether you tried not to take any side whatsoever. But it really was a civil war. And I think they saw it that way.
Right, right. Now, one thing that I found interesting, I think it was Josiah Quincy Jr. at one point took a sailed to South Carolina and then traveled back up through all the colonies to see what was going on in the other colonies, because in Massachusetts, because most of the kind of initial rebellion was in Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And so, and they didn't know how people, you know, what was going on in the other colonies. And he seemed to not even really know how the other colonies were being governed or what the situation was there at all. I found that, of course, that's, you know, it's so much different today where, you know, everything's instant communication. But how did the colonies even come to be able to unite with such limited knowledge about what what was happening in another place?
Yeah, it's a good question, because he had a batch of letters to introduce himself to some of the leading people. And he was really shocked by, you know, the sad state of the law in South Carolina and what was going on. Although he did write Abigail, comparing the ladies of Charleston to the ladies of Massachusetts. But it really gives you a glimpse of how he saw things. And a lot of the people far from Massachusetts felt that Massachusetts was just going its own way and it was going to get them all in trouble. And they didn't really have that much sympathy. So it really took these committees of correspondence. It took some fairly rough treatment of Massachusetts by the British to help to bring them all together in the Continental Congress. And also, of course, appointing Washington as the commander in chief, because he was from Virginia. And so it showed it wasn't just Massachusetts's battle here. And there were a lot of contributions from other states or colonies, as they then were, to help feed the people in Boston after their harbor was closed off. So it took a while, and there were still serious divisions. And, you know, the Times of Time and Souls came from Paine's book called Crisis. At first, there was all this enthusiasm. And then after a year of war, people got tired. Nobody wanted to volunteer. They had to start paying bounties to people to volunteer for even the short service in the Continental Army. And it's interesting because in Massachusetts and in the North, you got a bounty and money. In South Carolina, you got three slaves.
Oh my goodness. So were there any actual battles in South Carolina, land battles, or, you know, that, or further south? Or was South Carolina the furthest, the most southern colony? I'm not sure.
Well, there's Georgia.
Georgia, okay.
And Florida, which Florida was.
Was it a colony at that time? I don't think.
Really, no, it wasn't. Yeah. But there was a battle for Charleston Harbor, because the British had controlled the sea, really, and they had this fleet that went up and down. And that Charleston Harbor used as a sort of barrier, this special kind of tree that they had that was kind of spongy. So when you tossed a cannonball at it, it popped back. But eventually, there was an American army defending South Carolina. a man named Lincoln, Benjamin Lincoln, who was in charge of that army. And the Congress wanted to ask the South Carolinians to arm their slaves, because they didn't have, there was a big proportion of slave, of colored people, African Americans, against white people in South Carolina in particular. So they would have a better chance, but they were afraid to do that, so they did not. They preferred basically to lose to the British. And that American army surrendered to the British, who took over Charleston.
Wow.
As you can see, there was still a great deal of cultural differences. And actually, after the, if you read the Articles of Confederation, it's almost like reading a treaty of sovereign nations. And it wasn't until you get the Constitution that they're.
And that took a while, but that's another book, right?
That's a story for another time.
Yes,
but
yes.
There was a lot of disparate views, and it took the war really to bring them together.
Yeah, there's so much about that this book really, that your book, The Times That Try Men's Souls, really sheds a different, gives a different perspective of the war. So it's something that I think is worth reading for sure.
Thank you. I just really wanted to get at what it was that generation experienced.
Absolutely. Well, we're about out of time, and we do always end with the quote. So I thought I'd read the quote from which the title of the book comes.
Okay.
Which is from Thomas Paine, Crisis, as you just mentioned. These are the times that try men's souls. The summer soldier and the sunshine patriot will, in this crisis, shrink from the service of their country. But he that stands by it now deserves the love and thanks of man and woman. And the people who chose the wrong side, if it had gone the other way, we'd be speaking a different, we'd be talking a different game right now, wouldn't we?
We'd be like Canada.
Yeah, we'd be like Canada.
You don't have it in us. My square bunch.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Joyce.
Thank you very much for inviting me. This has been a real pleasure.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Bye.